I'm Tony Gargan, and welcome to the Presenting, Pitching and Public Speaking podcast.
So welcome to the Brave, Bold, Brilliant podcast. I'm your host, Jeanette Linfoot, and I am joined today by an incredible woman. She is an entrepreneur. She's a property investor. She's a public speaker. So I am absolutely delighted to welcome Tony Gargan to the Brave, Bold, Brilliant podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Jeanette. It's really weird having the tables turned, and I'm honoured to be interviewed on your podcast.
Excellent. Oh, listen, it's great to see you, Tony. It really is. And you're a busy lady, so I appreciate you taking the time. I think a great place to start, if you don't mind, Tony, would be just take us through your journey, where life started for you, how you've ended up where you are, and kind of all the twists and turns along the way, if that's all right.
Yeah, not a problem. How long have you got? So I, as people can tell, I am a Scouser. I am from Liverpool. So it all started with me in Liverpool, went to, you know, local high school. I'm from a council estate in Liverpool. So it was deemed that I would follow in the footsteps of everyone else. All the males in my family became plasterers. All of the females went into job roles where they could work their way up. And that was what I did. And I can't really tell you whether there was like a light bulb moment or a we should do something different. I think for me, the change came when I met my husband, Chris, and he'd always wanted to do something different. I think he's quite entrepreneurial anyway. He's always had lots of ideas and never really done anything with them. And being the person that I am, you know, I'm always the supporter. I'm always the person who helps and supports other people. Long story short, he was in a job that he really hated. So I never intended to be an entrepreneur. I was a HR manager. That was the role that I fell into. So from going to university, which was just an expectation, didn't really want to, didn't know what I wanted to do, basically. I mean, I'm in my late 30s now, and I still don't want to know what I'm going to be when I grow up or if it'll ever happen. But I went to university because it was expected of me. So I picked a really like generic course. I did business administration and marketing because in my final year, I had to choose an angle. I went down the marketing route solely because the other options were finance and I'm rubbish with numbers and HR. And I thought, oh, can't be dealing with people day in, day out. That's just not for me. So I finished university and went on to a graduate course. Totally fell into the roles that I've been in. And to be fair, if I look at it, a lot of people around me did exactly the same, kind of fell into the job role, just progressed within it. So I was working as a part-time job in a supermarket while I was in university. In fact, I had two or three jobs at a time. So from a really hard-working family, and it was, you know, if you want something, you work really hard for it. So because of that, I always had like two or three jobs, and I worked in a call centre and I worked in a supermarket. So when the time came for me to graduate and that big question of what are you going to do now, I was like, I don't know. Didn't know what I wanted to do. So I was offered to attend the graduate course at the supermarket that I worked in, which was Morrison's. So I just kind of fell into it. And from an honesty perspective, it was because a lot of my friends who really knew what their path was, really knew what they were doing. They were going and taking jobs and they were quite low paid, and then they were going to work their way up. And the salary for this graduate course was really good. And I thought, yeah, that'll do. So I think many people do that, don't they? We'll do this for a little while. It'll be a stopgap. And then about 12 months, it was meant to be an 18-month programme. And around 12 months in, I got asked, did I want to apply for a senior management role as a HR manager? Bearing in mind, in university, it was like, can't be dealing with people. But I think because I've been asked to do it, it gave me a bit of confidence. And I'm very much a, let's just say yes and figure it out type person. You know, if I hate it, I can always go back to operational. So I became a HR manager and a senior manager within Morrison's at the age of 21. Which was quite young for a senior management role. And I faced a lot of challenges in that, given that, you know, I'd have people say, I want to speak to the manager. And I've always been like, I was always in smart business dress, always wore heels, always kind of portrayed a certain image. And people, I think people made assumptions, or they judged me unfairly. And a lot of the time it'd be, oh, I want to speak to the manager. And because I was quite young, I was like, oh, I am the manager. And then it was over. Everyone just expected it to be a man, and a man in his 40s or 50s, and I saw that as a real challenge. And I held that role for about 12 years, and I loved being a HR manager. I didn't actually love the job, which is the amazing part about hindsight, is that I loved working with people, and that's been the thread that's continued all of the way through, because my husband, who was in a job that he hated, he said we should become property investors. And I was like, no, because when I was in my early 20s, I bought a house in Chester because I was living in Liverpool and working in Chester, and the commute was, it was a nightmare each morning. It was, I had an extra time on. So I bought a house in 2007, height of the market, paid far too much for it. Bought it with the wrong person. We subsequently split up, and I was left with this house that was a negative equity. And it was just like, oh, what have I done? So I made the decision to move back to Liverpool, move back home to the family home, which was not an easy decision to make. But I rented the house out. So because I'd paid too much for the house, it wouldn't have just worked as a standard rental. So I became an illegal multi-let landlord. Didn't ask for permission to rent the house out, didn't understand the difference. I mean, I can laugh at it now. Didn't know the difference between a buy-to-let mortgage, a residential mortgage. Didn't know that I needed consents or any kind of material changes to the house to turn it into a HMO. It was just a case of, I've got a problem, and it's that I need to pay the mortgage and I can't afford this and all of my other bills. So I rented it out room by room, and I hated every second of it. I hated it. I self-managed it because I thought I couldn't afford to rent it out. I'd never intended to be a property investor or a landlord. And I think there's a distinct difference between being a property investor and a landlord now. But back then, I didn't realise that. I was definitely a landlord and not a very good one. I hated it. So eventually, when my husband said, oh, we should invest in property, it was like, are you on glue? Like, have you seen the mess I've made of this? And that's when I came across Progressive Property. I was dragged along, didn't want to be there, didn't intend to stick with it, because I'd gone to a different training company with my husband Chris a year before, and we were looking to invest with some friends, just a bit of an idea, and it was like, oh well, we can see how this works. And I didn't like the whole premise, the irony now that I'm a trainer for Progressive. I didn't like the whole premise of teach you something and then pay for a training course and have no support, and it felt wrong. So for a year, Chris researched all of the different training companies, listened to webinars, really educated himself by reading lots of books. And so I'm really fortunate that we fell into property, because my husband nagged at me enough to get me along to an event, and then Progressive put on such a good event that it's weird when I look back now, because it went from me being like, yeah, property might work, I'm not really sure about it, to, oh my God, Peter Jones, I want your job, I want to be a speaker and a trainer. It was one of those defining moments, I think, where people present you an opportunity and you see something in it. And I think I still had all of the fears and concerns in the back of my head of, you know, you're still a scouser. I was a full-time mum, still am. I can't get rid of them that easily. So we had a really tough few years investing in property, because, you know, I'm from Liverpool. We don't, you know, people don't just throw money at you when you and I have this northern affinity, don't we? And
we do.
I think that also brings these fears and concerns, I think, for quite a lot of people. So I'm from a family who've worked hard for everything, you know, plastering being the trade. So quite cyclical in terms of when there's lots of work, there's lots of money, and when there's no work, there's none. Older brothers and sisters all gone into job roles. I'm the youngest of six kids. So there's four and then a 10-year gap and then two of us, and the older four, the two males, had gone into the plastering trade just following dad's footsteps, and my elder sister had gone to university and was studying, and my next sister, so my other sister, was a chef. She wanted to be a chef. She's always wanted to do it, and she worked really hard to do that, waiting on studying, you know. So everyone's worked really, really hard, and I think when you're surrounded by that, the assumption is that it's always going to be hard. So when it came to us investing in property, it was like I was used to the hard work because I'd worked really hard in my job. Chris had worked so hard in his job, and I think you just get used to that, you know, when you're surrounded by it all of the time. So we were willing to put in a little bit of hard work, and in quite a short space of time, while working full time, both of us, and having two young kids, the boys were one and almost four when we started investing. We raised finances, we built our first, you know, we bought our first house, and then we bought the next one, and it kind of snowballed from there. And I think this entrepreneurial spark just appeared. I think Chris had always had it, I think my other half had always had it, but I'd not. And I think sometimes it takes for you to achieve something before you give yourself any credit for it. And yeah, it kind of snowballed from there. So now we have a really successful property portfolio. We've got over 70 buy-to-let portfolios where, you know, over £6.5 million. We've done all of it using other people's money, mainly from necessity at the start. But I'm a massive believer in helping other people. And so our portfolios, a lot of it is just Chris and I who own it, but a big chunk of it is owned with joint venture partners and business partners who've invested in us, where we've done the kind of the work element, they've invested their funds and we jointly own it. So we've achieved quite a lot in the last kind of 5.5 years in property. And that led to me becoming a speaker and trainer for Progressive and Progressive Success, which I absolutely love. It is the thing that I enjoy the most, other than spending time with my family, obviously, but it's the thing. I don't know if you've wanted to do something, but you've got fears around it, and then you do it and it's like, oh, I'm actually quite good at this. And then the reception from other people, and they give you compliments and they say you've inspired them. And I think that just sparked this desire in me to, one, improve myself, to, two, help other people, and three, I'd say, to realize that actually all of the things that kind of set you up in life don't have to dictate the route that you go down. And I'm a massive believer in helping other people to understand that and realize their own potential, which is obviously where you and I then met.
Yeah. Oh my God, Tony, it's brilliant. There's so much in here. I mean, this is going to be fantastic. Thank you so much. I mean, just to pick up on a couple of things, if I may, there's a common theme here, I think, with you around, and you know, about work ethic. And, you know, there's a saying, isn't there? If you do what's easy, life will be hard. If you do what's hard, life will be easy. And I think, you know, your approach and attitude to sort of really that grafting hard to make things happen, and that no one gives you anything for nothing. That do you think that came from sort of your background and being, you know, the position in the family, or where do you think it came from? Is that from your mum and dad?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it's what you see day in, day out. And I think only now when I look back, and I've done a lot of looking back, I think you're surrounded by things and you just do. Like when we were younger, we were always told you work really hard in school, you know, your grades are a reflection of the work that you put in. And yes, I'd definitely say my work ethic comes from my parents. You know, my dad has been a plasterer his whole life. He left school. He's really intelligent, dad. He's super smart. You know, he's the person that I would go to if I wanted an answer to a question. You know, I'd go to dad before I'd pick up an encyclopedia when I was younger because he's so smart. But I think the work ethic and the hard work took over. So he had like loads of challenges when he was younger. He had an accident when he was younger, and he was effectively dragged along a road, and has scars from the top of his back right the way down to the bottom of his back. He was dragged along a tarmac road as a child and spent a lot of time in hospital, well over a year in hospital, had a number of skin grafts. So he's got permanent reminders of that. And I think that work ethic comes all the way back to there. And I've never really thought about it until you asked me this question, to be honest. I think he could have wallowed in a hospital bed at, you know, a really young age. He was a child. But he's always had this desire to learn. And I think he read so much. He asked questions of everyone, you know. He knows so much about medicine and about hospitals because he would always be inquisitive as a child. And I think from there, it was like he just went into the hard work. He's been a grafter his whole life. So I think it was around 14 or 15, he started working as a plasterer because his dad was a plasterer too. So it's a bit of a family tradition. And he worked really hard, you know, out first thing in the morning before we got up for school. He'd do his day job and then he'd do odd jobs. So he'd either be working in the house where mum would give him jobs to do, or, you know, neighbours needed plaster and he'd go and do those. And mum worked really hard as well. It was like, I think when you're surrounded by it, it becomes the norm, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You know, mum used to work like two jobs at a time. She used to drop us at school in the morning. She was a cleaner in the local supermarket. She'd done a bit of everything. And I think my older brothers have obviously gone into plastering, so it was hard work, early mornings, late finishes, you know, physical work. My older sister's university studying really hard, and then one as a chef. And I think being the youngest of six, I don't think it, I can't remember it ever being told that you've got to do this or you must do that. You know, I always remember being told you should try your best. And I think that was nurtured in us, you know, if you did well in an exam or whatever, you were always praised. We were always praised for the hard work that we put in. And I think that's probably created the cycle, and you work really hard, you get good results, you get praised for it, which makes you want to do it all of the more. And I think it probably does come back to childhood, yeah. Mm. And it's never really dawned on me before. I've never, ever, I don't think I've ever even told anyone that about Dad. And how his, like, he's still got this massive desire to learn now. He's 84. And he's still, you know, he does a crossword every single day, reads all of the newspapers, he loves going to museums and galleries, and he's always educating himself, and I reckon it probably comes back to that.
Yeah, that's so inspiring, isn't it? Because I just think that constant desire to be a better version of yourself, to learn. And, you know, I think that as soon as you stop doing that, you may as well hang your boots up, you know. But you've obviously got that from your dad. And that's, you know, because you've reinvented yourself quite a few times, Tony. If you think about your career, you know, you were in corporate in that HR leadership role for 12 years. That's quite a long time. And I know you said that the desire to get into property was probably ignited more from your husband, Chris, than necessarily yourself. But how big a change was that for you, jumping out of the, you know, a corporate role, which you loved, you know, because I think a lot of people, when they talk about getting into property, very often it's, oh, I hate my job, I want to get out of my job, I want to sack my boss. And certainly I never felt like that about my corporate career. I loved the jobs I've done. So it was never a moving away from something that I hated to do something new. But for you, how did that transition feel like in reality, to sort of leave what you loved to, for the chance of something great, but not really knowing how that was going to play out?
Yeah, it was, there was definitely some fears around it. I think I've always been the type of person who, I don't mind change and I'll adapt to change, but I won't just jump from one to another. Mm. So I think even back to when I had like two or three jobs at university, a lot of the time they came about because I would take a job and I'd be working hard within it. So my first job was working in a clothes shop when I was like 16. And then I got the opportunity to take a job in a call centre, but I worked the two alongside one another because my fear was if I jump out of the job, which I didn't really like in retail, but it paid, you know, it earned me some money, into the call centre, and what if I hate it? So I worked the two alongside one another while I was in school. And that was quite tough in terms of time, and I was really busy. But I actually continued to do that for a little while and then went, right, okay, I like the job in the call centre, I'm going to keep that. And then I think I'd been so used to being busy and I'd been so used to earning decent money that I then took another job, which is when I took the job in Morrison's in the supermarket, and I worked both alongside. And I did the same with property. Chris did need to get out of a job that he hated, but he's also ridiculously risk averse, would never just jump from a job into property. And it scares me when I train people and they go, oh, I've just left my job. And I'm like, oh, no, don't do that. Because even if you hate your job, you know, what if you don't like property? What if it doesn't work out? So it was a difficult transition in that it was probably the hardest we've ever really worked was during that time. And I look back now, because people ask that question, how did you fit it all in? And I'm like, honestly, I couldn't give you a simple answer. I don't know. You just do. Like, you had to fit it in. So I did. It was very stressful. So I worked full-time in my job, Chris worked full-time in his, and we started doing property. We had this non-negotiable 10 hours per week, which was, you know, whether it be networking, reading books, attending an event, viewing houses. There was a non-negotiable 10 hours per week. And we obviously had to split that up quite a lot because our two little boys were so young. And then I still didn't leave the job. I was going to keep my job because, similar to you, it was like, I love the job. Hindsight, I don't think it was the actual job that I loved. I think it was the role that I had and the amount of people that I got to help. And I think a lot of it was in comparison. Like when you hear people exactly as you've just said, who go, oh, I hate my job. It was like, well, in comparison, I don't. So I must love my job because, you know, I don't mind getting up for work every morning. I know that I've got to do something and I know that it's going to be hard work. So you've just got to crack on with it. So it was tough, the transition, because we'd done this to get Chris out of his job and then we'd replaced an income inside of 12 months. And it was like, well, we've replaced your income, Chris, now you can leave your job. And because he's so risk averse and he's a lot more fearful than I am of the potential consequences. So it was like, you should leave your job. And his phrase was always, one more house, we'll get one more house. And I'd already started training to be a trainer for Progressive as well, because I'd seen this. I had this desire to help other people. I loved the idea of standing on a stage and delivering training, where in my HR role, I had to do that as part of the job role, which was to induct all of the new recruits and train them up. But none of them wanted to be there. It was like they had to be in the room, you know? So I wanted to turn it on its head because I love the training side of it, but I wanted to do that for people who'd volunteered to be there rather than strong-armed. So it was tough, to be honest, because then it was a case of one of us is going to leave our job. Like, this can't continue. It got to a point where we were working so hard and I'm sure people can relate to it, that something's going to give. And I was like, well, property's not going to give because that's the thing that's given us this additional income. Speaking and training was never on the cards to be given up. So it was a case of you leave your job or I do. And because I was the one who was doing the speaking, the training, all of the travel to Peterborough, I dropped down hours first. So I went from 5 days to four, and then quite quickly went from 4 days to three. And when I went down to 3 days, I realised that I was basically doing a full-time job in 3 days, and it was now just much more stressful. So 2016... I handed in my notice to leave my job, and I've always been a bit of a geek. You know, I have this innate desire to please people, which I think is why I do what I do. So I gave more notice than I needed to give because I volunteered to train up whoever was going to take over my role because I genuinely cared for the people that I worked for. I think the reasons we improved so much as a store, so I was obviously the HR side, I think we improved so much as a store because I cared about them and they cared about me. You know, I'd look after them if they needed a day off. I'd try and swap things around, but there was always, you need to, you know, it's give and take. And we got absenteeism right down, sickness right down. We got retention, you know, it changed completely. Our labour turnover was so high and we managed to retain a lot more staff. I think that was based on the people that we were recruiting. So as a HR department, we'd changed everything. So I really wanted someone to come in and kind of someone to pass the baton to. And I think that's where the turning point came for me, realizing that it wasn't the job that I loved. It was the people, because they didn't replace me. There was no HR manager to come and take over. I'd given this extra month of notice to train someone up. And it was like, well, we'll take what you're giving us, but we don't care. And I thought, oh my God, like, I care about the staff more than the corporation does. And that was a big turning point for me. And I was lost probably for a first couple of months because I was so used to doing so much, working two young kids, speaking, training. So I jumped feet first into everything property and public speaking. So it was a tough transition. And again, it's one of those things where it's like, it's a few years ago now. So you kind of block out the difficult parts and just, it was very much the case of you just get on with it. So it was quite tough. And obviously there was a fear there, and especially because Chris is so risk averse. It was like, well, what if it doesn't go any better? What if we don't buy any more properties? What if you don't earn any money through speaking and training? And I think I'm very much, there is no chance of that happening. You'll find a way. So yeah, it was tough. It was definitely tough, but with hindsight, one of the best things that I ever could have done.
It's really interesting, Tony, because I think a lot of people listening will have a real affinity to a lot of what you've gone through personally and you and Chris as a team, because, you know, I think fear can be such a debilitating thing for people that they never actually make that move. And what I love about what you've described is you found a way to manage the risk and face the fear by running things in parallel. And that's obviously a theme for you, you know, as you've said. But I think, you know, there's a real message there for people that there isn't one size fits all, but if you have a dream to do something, find a way to get you there that's congruent with yourself. You know, you don't have to try and do it someone else's way. And I think that's a really good sort of approach that you've taken, which probably a lot of people would benefit from thinking about. How do you start something on the side, even if it's a side hustle? You know?
I think a lot of that came from Chris's fears as well. You know, I'm a massive believer, you know me well enough now to know that I'm a massive believer that you have to have people around you who support you. And I think Chris and I are really lucky that we are very different people, but that we work well in a team, in that he is a lot more risk averse than me. So he does stop me from, you know, making stupid decisions or jumping feet first. But I think until then, again, you don't realise that, I've always done that. I've always kind of hedged my bets, and I've never left one job to jump to another because what if? But that you find a way to make it work. And it was probably more difficult in that way in terms of trying to fit it in time-wise, but I suppose it negated the risk. And I do agree. We see a lot of people, especially in what I do, who have this massive desire to achieve things, but the fear holds them back. So I always say that a little bit of fear serves as well, because it stops us from making stupid mistakes, but too much fear definitely holds us back. And I would go as far as to say, as you do, that it's debilitating for some people. So they never realise their potential. They never realise the success that can come out of the hard work, because a lot of people continue to do the hard work and never gain the rewards. Or, you know, it's the Stephen Covey analogy, and I'm really visual. So the Stephen Covey analogy, whereas you can be progressing and you can be moving, and he talks about climbing a ladder. You do the work and you climb the ladder, but sometimes your ladder's leaning against the wrong wall. And some people are doing that in a corporate role where they don't really love it. And they, you know, they can reach the highest heights, they can get to the top of the ladder, but when they look out, the thing they want is over the other side. So it's about leaning your ladder against the right wall. And I'd say you definitely need support to get there. And I'm really fortunate that, you know, although my husband wants to punch me in the face regularly because I go, let's do this massive thing, let's do this huge thing. And he's like, let's think about it a little bit. So I think we work well, and I drag him along into some decisions, and he kind of holds the reins a little bit and pulls me back when I'm going a little bit too far beyond our means.
The perfect combination. Well, that's very much like my Chris and I as well. You know, we're really different people. I mean, you wouldn't put us together at all, probably, people, you know, but actually it works because we are quite different, and the combination is great. So let's just talk a little bit about the portfolio you've built, right? Because, I mean, those some impressive numbers there, Tony. You know, 6.5 million GDV, gross development value of the property, 70 buy-to-lets you've got, and mainly using other people's money. So, you know, how did you approach the getting into the property from a financing point of view? Because I think a lot of people, that's probably what they struggle most with. And I haven't got a lot of my own money to get going. So could you want to talk about that? Because you've built a significant portfolio there. And as you say, not actually using your own money, certainly to start off with anyway.
I think it started. So when I said we'd gone along to this training with Progressive, I really thought, well, we've got no money, so we can't do it. And although Chris is the more cautious of us, he's always wanted to invest in property. So we started looking at the alternative options, using other people's money, creating win-win situations. So a lot of the time people have friends, family members, acquaintances, people around them who can help them out with it. And that was definitely the case with us. And it was never a case of going to ask people, can you loan us some money? You know, we weren't poor by any means. You know, we were both in good jobs, we earned a good salary. But when I convey this to the people that I now train, I explain it in terms of most of us live to our means. So whatever our disposable income is usually gets disposed of in some way, shape or form. You know, and the more you earn, the more you do the things that you want to do. So you'll buy a better car, or you'll go on a big holiday, etc. So we were never poor, but we were definitely not rich. We didn't have any savings. And again, I think that comes back to, you know, your families as well, because we'd kind of lived to our means in terms of when the business was there and business was booming in plastering. we'd enjoy the successes of that. You know, we'd have some nice things, but when money was tight, it was really tight. Mm. And I think that had kind of swayed my mindset around it was, you know, you're either the haves or the have nots. If you're the have nots, you work really hard for what you want, or you're the haves and you just come into it. I had a massive mindset change around money, which made the biggest difference, because I realised, and it was again being surrounded by the right people, being part of Progressive, where all of these people were just like raising money and, you know, she's invested in me and he's invested in this. And I had this thought process in my head of, well, that's okay for them, but it won't work for me. So I think seeing other people do it, I found really inspiring, and I wanted to understand the detail and the minutiae of that. How did it work? So joint ventures really appealed to me, because I think at the back of my head was still this kind of you're not worthy of money approach. Yeah. So I thought, well, you're going to have to work really hard for it. And we did. But we had family members who watched what we were doing. And, you know, when you have those conversations of how are things and what are you doing, my approach of do it and just find a way meant that we'd come off the back of a train and I'd done all of the viewings on all of these properties and put offers in, and one got accepted, and it was a little bit like, oh, what do we do now? Like, this is meant to be a good thing, but how are we going to do it? And long story short, by just talking to people, so friends and family members, it was two family members in particular, we managed to piece together the deposit to buy this property. Spoke to a family friend who was a mortgage advisor, who got us a mortgage on it. And so that was the first kind of step into joint ventures. And if I'm really honest, I think the big thing for me was I just wanted to pay them back and prove that it could be done. Mm. The people pleaser inside of me, but it's also, you know, if someone challenges me to do something and says, you can't do it, I'm like, watch me go, watch me prove it. And by hook or by crook, I'll find a way. But I just wanted to prove to family members that we could buy this house, refurbish it, and then add value enough to pay them back. And we did that in a really short space of time. This was kind of 2015. You could get mortgages, you know, by having my previous experience as a landlord, where I've made loads of mistakes on the illegal multi-let property, actually qualified us for an additional mortgage. We moved on to a commercial mortgage, and inside of like 3 months, we bought a house, refurbished it, and refinanced it. And I just wanted to pay back these family members. But obviously, we were paying them back with an interest rate, and it was like, go again. So that kind of started it. And then being part of like the Progressive and the communities that I was part of, networking with people, they see your success. And it was like, we've just done one. And it was like, oh, well, if you get any more of those, give us a shout. And so we started to raise finance from people who had money sat in a bank that wasn't really earning anything. And these were people who knew and understood property. And I thought the only people who will loan you funds are people who can't do it themselves. But a lot of the time it's that you can provide a solution to a problem that you don't realise is a problem, which is, you know, it's a first world problem, but money sat in a bank not earning a huge amount. And we're definitely seeing that now with, you know, verging on negative interest rates. So it was about, it's always been about creating win-win situations for me. It's always been about joint ventures of being customer service based. So we have a rule that we only work with a small number of people at any given time so that they get a good customer service. And that probably comes back from my retail days of the repeat custom from the customers who got a good service. So we raised finances from family members and friends, from people within the Progressive community, and we would either buy and jointly own the properties, which meant that we had this kind of shared risk and shared reward, or that we would loan funds. And we'd done that and got to kind of 20 or odd properties, just recycling and doing the same thing. Because tell everyone what you do, absolutely, because you do one and you tell people, and then other people go, oh, I've got money set in the bank. So that kind of snowballed a little bit. And then most recently, we've bought a couple of different portfolios, one being just Chris and I. And again, it's loaned funds, and we used a bridge for the first time, and we've used secured loans and unsecured loans. And we bought quite a significant portfolio. And I think that was, we've done this for a little while now, let's do something for us. And we also bought a smaller portfolio, but still a decent size. It was 14 properties with a joint venture partner where we've purchased them. And we're now just kind of, we've jettisoned some off, we've sold some, we've kept some. And that's helped us to amass the portfolio that we now have. You know, it's a decent sized portfolio. We sat down and done some figures on it over the last couple of days, because one of the things that we always do is we revisit what we're doing. We do kind of a red, amber, green, revisit what we're doing, what needs to stop, what do we need to start doing, or what needs to continue in the way that it is. And so we've done a little assessment of it, and that the rent roll of the portfolio, both ours and jointly owned, is over 370,000 a year. And it's like, that's far beyond, you know, we were in kind of the average earning salaries, you know, the average for the UK is in the 20s, and we were in the 20s and 30,000s for the job roles that we did. And this was like, the hard work pays off. And I genuinely believe that the biggest part of that is you gain more by helping other people. So we've helped people build portfolios, our joint venture partners, we do kind of the legwork side of it, and we shield them from some of the problems, and they invest in the properties, which enables us to do it in this kind of win-win situation, whether it be straight loans or joint ventures. I think that's what gets you further, faster.
Yeah, and listen, I mean, listening to what you know, how you've approached it, Tony, I mean, it does show, doesn't it, that anyone can do this if you set your mind to it and you approach it in a way that's congruent with your values, you know, and you learn from others that have gone before, you really can achieve anything. And I think that goes for property, business, career, anything in life, really, doesn't it? You know, because there you were Absolutely. Thinking, you know, gosh, where do we even start? And here you are today sitting with, you know, 6.5 million quid's worth of property. I mean, that's phenomenal. And, you know, between you, that's really something to be proud of. Can I ask you a question about your approach to risk now? Because, you know, you spoke a lot around sort of being relatively risk averse in your sort of earlier life and career and what have you. How's that changed, or has it not changed at all, would you say?
I don't actually think I'm that risk averse. I think I just hedge my bets. And I think it's only recently that I've spent some time thinking about it. I don't think I'm massively risk averse. I do a lot of due diligence. I do the kind of legwork up front. So I think if you think back to the jobs that I did, I'd apply for the job. The risk would be, I'm going to apply for this new job because I want a new job. But then a little bit of fear would be, oh, but you know, the fear of the unknown, I reckon, is the biggest one with me. And it would be, well, what if I jump into this job that I hate and then I can't go back to the one that's just okay? So I reckon I hedged my bets a little bit with those in terms of the jobs. Once it's got bigger and we've done more things, I don't think I'm massively risk averse. I just think I do a lot of due diligence. I call it doing the legwork up front. I do the due diligence. I look at all of the options. I weigh up the what can go wrong and what if it goes wrong. I look at every different scenario, both from a financial and, you know, a well-being perspective, and, you know, the effect, because we've got two young children. I mean, they're not very young now, they're 10 and almost 7. And I think that I spend a lot more time kind of focusing on the impact on other people. I don't think I worry about me as much, you know, I'll just get on with it because that's the nature, because that's what parents told us to do, that's what older brothers and sisters did. I think I've become a little bit more risk averse, or at least tried to eliminate, mitigate and reduce risk an awful lot more since I've had a husband who I care about and kids who I care about and worry about those. Yeah, I don't think I'm massively risk averse. I'm very much if I see something that I want, I'll do everything in my power to get it. If someone challenges me and says that you can't do it, even if it's risky, I'll do everything in my power to mitigate the risk, but I'll do it anyway. So I don't think I'm massively risk averse. I think having a husband who is a very good thing for me, because it stops me from doing stupid things. But I also think the desire to always continue and to improve means that I've allowed myself to say yes to opportunities, even if I've not been 100% sure on what the outcome would be. Because I think that you have enough people around you, you educate yourself well enough, whether that's kind of formal education or just, you know, educate yourself by the risks that you've taken previously and learn from those. I do a lot of reflection on what went well, you know, the red, amber, green approach, what went well, what will we continue to do? Where did I majorly balls up, and what should I avoid again next time? Yeah, so I'd say I've probably become more aware of risk and I'm more cautious before I jump feet first. But I'd say that's more based on the people around me and not wanting people around me to be affected by it.
Yeah, and it, maybe it links back to what you said earlier, Tony, about being a bit of a geek, bit of a girly swat. You know, you do your homework and that gets you comfortable.
Yeah, it absolutely will be.
That's smart, right? That's a smart thing to do. Can we talk about sort of, you know, you've mentioned a couple of times about you being a people pleaser. And, yes. you know, it, whether it was in the HR role that you had or how you want to, you know, sort of, I suppose, you know, do the right thing by people, which is a good thing. Do you think any of that comes from your position in the family? I mean, it must have been pretty crowded in your house. You know, you're the youngest of six. Yeah. how did that influence you, do you think?
I think, again, it's one of those things that you look back on and identify, because when you're in the thick of it, you don't really realise. But yeah, definitely, you know, I've got four siblings who are quite a bit older than me, and then there's a 2-year gap in me and my sister who's closest to me. There's two years between us. There's four girls and there's two boys. Mum and dad kind of raised us in that way, that you're always a respectful person, you'll always work really hard. And I think because of that, I always wanted to please them. You know, I'd be excited to come home with a good report, or, you know, if I'd been picked for a team or something. And I think a lot of that comes from a need to be acknowledged. And I do think that's because I'm the youngest of six. You know, I was like the baby of the family and I was kind of looked after quite a lot. I know I was given more opportunities than my older brothers and sisters. You know, they never let me get away with it. They always knew it. It'd be like, oh, Mum never would have let me get away with that. Oh, you're the favourite, you're the baby. So I think it was probably a point proving exercise. But yeah, definitely, you know, being from such a big family, I always wanted everyone to like me. I wanted all the teachers in school to like me, but I also wanted all the kids in school to like me. I think my fear was around not fitting in, or a fear around, you know, displeasing people or people being disappointed in me. You know, when you hear of people's parents who, you know, when they've said, oh, I'm not angry or upset, I'm just disappointed.
Yeah.
That, you know, that I have a literal reaction to that. It makes the hairs on the back of my neck stand up. And I think it definitely comes from my childhood. And I think I've always imposed that on myself as well. Mm. You know, I've always wanted to be the best. If I got, you know, lower marks in an exam than I wanted, or if I didn't get picked for a team, then I beat myself up over it. I saw it as a direction of something that I could have done better or more. So I think I'm also my own worst critic. And I think that's definitely kind of manifested in my desire to continue improving, and wanting to always, like, I always want something more, which is both a blessing and a curse, because it means that you don't then look back at how far you've come. And I think a lot of that comes externally from me, you know, when other people will say, oh, you've achieved this or that, and I'm like, yeah, thanks. But I'm always moving the goalposts. So it is a conscious decision for me. I have to consciously celebrate wins and make a conscious effort to not be so busy setting the next goal, challenge or task that I don't give me and the people around me credit for what we've achieved. I don't know whether that will ever change in time. I think it's in my nature, but you can manage it a little bit better. So, you know, if I deliver a speech and people give me credit, I'll always take that and I'll take it on board, because I want to do that again next time. But even if I've got the best reaction or the best sales result or conversion or whatever, I'll always look on how it can be improved. I'll take the feedback and I'm learning to just say thank you rather than, you know, I see this in so many people, and it's so easy for me to teach others to do it. Sometimes the hardest person to do is yourself. And I gave this example of the most recent training that I was at, and you know, I love giving compliments. If I really like, you know, I really love your scarf, it's really pretty. And so often I'll hear people just go, oh, thank you. Whereas if someone says that to me, I'm like, oh, it's only from New Look. Or yeah. I'll tell people how much it cost. And I think even though I was praised a lot as a child, I would always try and kind of deflect. So that is a conscious effort as well, to say thank you and then just shut up.
Yeah, I think it's linked to the whole imposter thing, isn't it, though, as well? Because, you know, you no matter how much your results and feedback you get from people, it tells you, should tell you logically, that you're doing great and you belong to have all the success and that, you know, the positions that you've got, etc. There's this little niggle in your head going, oh, it's just luck, it's just down to chance, I don't really deserve it, I don't really belong here. And I certainly recognize a lot of that in myself and my position in the family. We've got a lot of similarities, I think, between ourselves, Tony, here. So yeah, I get that. that. Yeah. And with the people pleasing side of it, obviously there's times when that has served you very well, right? Because it means that you're a kind, generous person, you care about others, you know, and all of that. Are there times when that has not served you well and has actually gone against you, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing major that sticks in my mind, but I think because I'm very much a people pleaser and I like to take people at face value, I'm very much, I believe in you and I'll trust in you until you prove me wrong. And I think that's not served me well in some instances where I've been too trusting of people, or because I want to please people, I've probably downplayed my wants and needs, you know, even down to it kind of, if we look at it in kind of granular level. You know, I'm rubbish at making decisions. I can make these massive decisions and these life-changing decisions on let's go and, you know, buy a massive portfolio. I've eliminated all of the risk as best I can. Let's go and do it. But I think the people-pleaser side of me means sometimes I've not got what I wanted or deserved because I've allowed other people to take the limelight or other people to, because I want them to feel it. I even think, like, you know, when you're in a group environment and everyone's like choosing where you go or choosing what meal that you have, I'm very much like, yeah, you just choose. And even in the back of my head, if I'm thinking I really want to eat that or really want to go there, I'll let them choose. And I think smaller level doesn't really bother me all that much. I can't think of any major instances where it's happened, but it probably has, mm-hmm. where, you know, in a job or in a business where I've allowed someone else to exert their authority. There's a couple of instances where, and I think it's more in a judgment base, where I've wanted to please people. We had people that we were looking to invest with, friends who we were looking to invest with when we first started looking at getting involved in property. And I think both Chris and I are from the work ethic of you work really hard. You know, his mum was a barber and used to work really long hours, always worked through the summer. His dad was a plumbing and heating engineer, so he used to work really long hours. So he spent a lot of time with his nan and his granddad. So I think he's always been around the hard work element. I have too. So when it comes to us investing in property and we have this non-negotiable 10 hours, we went to viewings, you know, we'd separate to do it because the kids were so young, wanted to stay at home. We'd do direct vendor letters, etc. So we put a lot of effort into it, and they were friends who we were looking at investing with, and Chris had been their friends for an awful lot longer than I had, and I'm talking from childhood, and bizarrely I'd known them from childhood, we knew the same people, but Chris and I never even met until we were in our kind of mid-20s, so we both knew them. And he'd been really good friends with them. And then we just carried that on when Chris and I got together, you know, we've got parents to each other's children, etc. And I remember the day when, so we'd gone to all of these viewings and it was like, I'm going to this viewing, I'm looking at this house. And it was like, oh yeah, I can't fit it in, I can't do this, blah, blah, blah. And it was like, well, we want to please people. We want to be successful. We don't mind doing this. So I remember going to this viewing, put the offer in, where I told you, we put this offer in on the house, it was accepted. And it was like, okay, what now? And then we managed to find the funds, etc. And I remember telling this particular friend, you know, we've had an offer accepted, we're going to be able to buy this house. And the look on her face, and it was just like, oh. And I said, well, you were invited to the view and you didn't want to come to it. You know, we'd spoken to them all of the way through and it was like they couldn't be bothered or they didn't want to do it or whatever. And when it come to the point of fruition, and here's me, you know, people please are expecting it to be like, oh, well done, good luck, if you need any help. But it was just like, no. And then, you know, the obvious way that happened in the mid-2000s, found out via Facebook that she was annoyed, you know, the usual way. Wow. And there was a comment on Facebook and it was something along the lines, I can't remember the exact words, but something along the lines of when people stab you in the back. And it floored me, like, you were given the opportunity to be a part of this. We've been, Chris and I have done all of the work, you know, we've gone out and sourced the funds, we've done all of the viewings, we've done everything up front. And that was really difficult for me, that we'd basically been friends with these people for such a long time and that they just didn't, we expected there to be like and all of the way along, Chris and I had said, you know, we'll let them join on board with us. We're happy for them to jump in and be a part of it. And the whole friendship dissolved over that, like not responding to texts or emails, So I think that's probably the one instance where being a people pleaser, and that was a big changing point for me, because I suppose the people pleaser in me would have gone, no, you should do this and, you know, come be on board. And I just thought it says an awful, I think because at this point I've been surrounding myself with a lot more people who were supporting us as well and who were doing it. And I just thought it says an awful lot more about you than it does of us. And yeah, it was really tough time.
Yeah, painful to feel that you've sort of been let down and someone that you thought you knew so well. Yeah.
And that they feel you've let them down. I think that's the big, the difficult part, because I'm this pleaser, you know. Hang on a minute, I've just gone up there and trying to make a better life for me and my kids, and we're happy for you to be along on the ride. And it was like, okay. And it just, it was difficult. That was a really tough few months. And it was like, I think it's just because I expect everyone to be the type of person that I am. And then you hear all of the rumours, because a lot of the people that we know each other. And it was like, when I heard a rumour of, it wasn't even a rumour, it was told to my face from, you know, direct from source, was someone had said to Chris, I hope they fall flat on their face. And this was the same people who we'd been working with. So then I had two choices. I either feel sorry for myself. In retrospect, I actually think I put two fingers up and went, watch me go. You know, you want to see me fall flat on my face. I'm going to prove you and everyone who tells me that I can't do it wrong. So my mission initially was to get 4 or 5 properties and get Chris out of a job that he hated. And now it's to build an empire that is the most secure thing and the best thing, to give my kids the most amazing life, and for Chris and I to reap the rewards of the hard work that we've put in, to help family members and friends who are along for the ride and show them that they can too. But there is also, I reckon I'm 99% fueled by desire to achieve and 1% fueled by spite. It's like, tell me.
Well, we're all human, aren't we? We're all human. But I mean, you know, at the end of the day, that, you know, this podcast is all about being brave, bold and brilliant. And I think you've just given there's so many examples here where, you know, jumping out of corporate and getting into property, you know, it was a brave move. You did it in your way that was right for you. But then when you talk about being bold and making an impact, you know, you've just said, so in whatever the period of time has been, you've gone from saying I'll have 4 properties to actually building an empire. Now, for me, that's the bold bit, you know, because there's no limit for you. And I love that. I really love that. The impact you make is fantastic. So can we just talk a little bit, Tony, about being a working mum? Because obviously your family is incredibly important to your two gorgeous boys and Chris as well. But you've got a lot going on. And I'm sure a lot of women listening to this will recognise this whole sort of elusive thing of balance, which I don't believe exists. but you know, the pressure as a working mum as well, trying to, you know, whether it's in your own business or in the corporate world. Do you want to talk a bit about how you manage that and your approach to motherhood and family alongside the business side?
Yeah, I think I completely agree with you. You know, how do you find a balance? Well, what is balance? Because it's different for different people. And I think I suffered major parental guilt, and we have a lot of people come to training and like I suffer what I call mum guilt, but I also know that there's, you know, Chris spends a lot of time with the boys now. And I think it's really bizarre, because once we'd had the boys, it was me who did a lot of the school runs, etc., because Chris worked from 5 in the morning. So I did all of the school runs. I still remember the fear and the stress coursing through my veins every time I had to leave work, and I knew I was leaving late because I was dealing with an issue, but I had to get to school to pick up my little boys. And I remember there's one stretch of the journey that I remember so vividly every time, thinking if I hit traffic now, I'm going to be late and those poor kids are going to be sat there waiting for me. And so I've always suffered from mum guilt, even when I was just working. A lot of it is external as well. A lot of it is the people who will judge you when they don't know your situation. People are going to judge you. And I remember Rob Moore's my mentor and has been for years. And I remember him saying the phrase to me, and it's stuck with me ever since. And it was, Tony, people are going to judge you anyway. So let them judge you for being who you are, standing for what you stand for and standing against what you stand against. And I think so often as parents or as carers, because a lot of the time, you know, a lot of the people that we see, it's like they're carers for elderly people in their family or whatever. There's this need to be helping and supporting when sometimes people will put their own dreams on hold for it. And I think that's probably where the bold part comes out, doesn't it? In that, you know, I've always wanted to give my children a better life, but there have been sacrifices along the way. Are the sacrifices I see as an investment? You know, there've been times I've made it my mission to always be there for the kids, but there have been times when I've had to make a choice, you know, when, especially when I was working full-time and learning to be a trainer and investing in property, because my days off would be spent in the car doing a 7-hour round trip to deliver a training day in Peterborough. So I don't think the guilt ever really goes away. I've got a lot better at dealing with it, but I think you've got to look at the outcome of it. So I saw that as investment of time in the initial to buy back time in the long run. Because when I was working in full-time in a job, you know, it was, well, you have to work to earn a good living, you know. You've got to spend time away from the kids, because if not, you can't afford for them to have the nice things in life. So that was deemed acceptable. But I think a lot of people, and I'm quite lucky that most of my family and friends understood it, not all of them, would be like, a lot of the guilt is imposed upon you, isn't it? By either expectations of, you know, the mum should be the one who's at home and not dad staying at home with the boys or whatever. That's what I've experienced. I know not everybody does. But I think a lot of people around us were fully supportive, but there were some who just didn't quite get it. Like you're saying, you're proclaiming that you want to give your boys this amazing life, yet there you are. You know, I've just spent 7 full days in Peterborough. I was Friday to Friday in Peterborough, and I get that some people don't understand that. One, I do it because I love what I do, and I'm a better mum for having time to do what I love to do. I'm a better mum because my children, yes, of course, they miss me while I'm away, and I miss them like mad, but you know, there's no better feeling than walking through the door to these two people running up and giving you the biggest hug. And it makes you, for me, and it's been a learning curve over the last few years, but for me, that makes me a better mum, because when I was here 24/7, you know, on the days when you need a little bit of a break and there isn't one, I think you can become a worse person for it. Like, I appreciate my time with the boys so much because I spend a big chunk of time away from them. But I suppose the big thing is it's on my terms. So I'll do 7 days away, I'll do 9 days away, and then I'm home for the next 2 weeks. I go for a day to Peterborough and back. I get the full 6 weeks of summer with them, and that's through choice. Over Christmas, like, there is non-negotiable time at all with the boys, and I think it's short-term pain for long-term gain. So if I'd have given up, and I think that's another part, if I'd have given up on what we were hoping to achieve, then it would have been time wasted, time away from the boys that you're never going to get back. Whereas I see that as a massive investment in both myself, and you've got to learn to be a little bit selfish because you can't pour from an empty cup. It's such a cliched phrase, but it's so true. You know, I'm a better person because of it. I appreciate my time with the boys so much more, and I know that they appreciate time with me. And this is a means to an end, because I could have spent 40, 50, 60 hours a week in the job that I was doing and still only earn a certain amount of money because it was capped, or, you know, only achieve a certain standard of lifestyle. And I think there's got to be some risk to gain the reward. And the risk was investing time and spending time away from the boys. Whereas, you know, I get an awful lot of time with my kids now. And I lost my mum when I was 21. So the big thing for me is my kids are going to remember the best of me, because they were getting the worst of me. You know, I don't know, you'll have it with, you know, with Chris even, you know, when you're working really long hours and you're stressed out and you're bringing the job home with you and they ask you, do you want a cup of tea? And it's like, no, you shout at them and everything becomes this stressful thing. And, you know, I remember saying phrases like, you've got no idea how difficult this is. I'm trying to do a full-time job in part-time hours. And one, that was quite selfish, but two, it was true. You know, we put so much pressure. And imagine if I was still doing that job, I'd still have a ceiling on what I could have earned. And in order to earn the additional money alongside, it would become more responsibility and therefore more stress and more time away from my little boys that someone else got to dictate. Whereas now I very much see it as, I still suffer the mum guilt. There's still times when I'm away and I miss being at home. But that's an investment, because if I decide tomorrow that I no longer want to be a speaker and a trainer and I no longer want to invest in property, I could spend every minute of every day with the boys. But I also know the type of person I am, and after a short space of time I'd go insane. So I think you've got to, you, not put your own hopes and dreams on the back burner, because what's that teaching your children, you know? If they see you being this person who's just 24/7 stressed, who's doing things that they don't want to do and don't enjoy doing, but there's no way out, I think I'm teaching my boys a far better lesson, which is, you know, do whatever you want to do. The world is your oyster. It's going to take a little bit of hard work, but the hard work will pay off, and you're going to lean a ladder against the right wall. And more so than anything, I can give them more opportunities because of that, because when they need me most, I'm here and will continue to be here. And that's the same for Chris as well. You know, I think we are very fortunate, but we also need to be proud of ourselves for having put in the legwork to get this far. And I think my kids get the best in that respect because they have a nice life and, you know, they want for nothing. But they understand the value of hard work, and they know that if you want to achieve anything in life, one, that you can, but two, you're probably going to need some help along the way. So treat other people as you want to be treated. Set yourself a goal and work towards it, and you can get there.
Well, I was going to ask you for what advice would you give, but there's just bucket loads in that last discussion. So no, that's great. I think you're absolutely spot on though. You know, I think if you're clear on your dreams and you keep reminding yourself of that, you know, and you do it in your way, be true to congruent to your values, and don't worry about what other people think about you, because at the end of the day, you know, you want to be kind and considerate and respectful, but you're the only one that's on your journey, aren't you? And I think that's the thing. So no, I think that's brilliant, brilliant advice. So one last question then, Tony, before we go. If you were going to give some advice to someone that is maybe has a dream and they've maybe had this dream for a while, whatever it is, could be business, could be life, you know, career, it could be personal, but they've not found the courage for whatever reason to kind of get themselves going with it, what advice would you give to them to try and break through that sort of barrier, whatever that may be?
Good question. Okay, so every training day, this I create this analogy. It came out at an event when I was in a joint venture training, and Hannah was my event manager, and remember trying to, I'm really visual, so try to make it a visual analogy, and I think this sums it up best, is that if we look at, you imagine a graph, over one side is pain and over the other side is pleasure. And if we have a pain that is driving us forward, we will move out of a situation. If you hate the job that you're in, you've got to do something to move out of it. If you don't like the relationship you're in, that you've got to make a change, that pushes us forward. If we have a dream or a pleasure or a goal and we set it, it should be a magnet and it should pull us towards it, but it doesn't always, because fear gets in the way. And I draw a line right down the middle of the board, which at the top I'll write comfort zone, and at the bottom I'll write danger zone. And the reason being, I think, if we don't engineer ourselves some pain, or we don't set a vision or a goal that is so magnetic that it draws us towards it, we are at risk of, you know, you're at risk of never achieving those goals. And so often we'll imagine the worst scenarios. Well, imagine if I do it and it doesn't go right. Imagine if I leave the job to set up this business and it falls flat on its face. Imagine, and what we are so good at is imagining the worst. So I think you need to, whatever that goal or vision is, you need to reverse engineer. You need to identify the steps along the way that are going to get you there. And sometimes those steps are things that you have to do. And sometimes those steps are bringing people in, you know, whether it be getting education or whether it be having a support network of people who just tell you that you can do it. So whatever this goal or vision is, it's just a goal, it's a dream, isn't it? Until we put the steps in place to get there. And that's where I talk about the ladder, because this is effectively a ladder and you are leaning your ladder against one wall right now. And if you don't, so I think you've got to get educated in whatever area it is, whether that be, and it doesn't have to be really expensive education. It can be, you know, surrounding yourself with people who are already doing it, reading success stories. Don't compare yourself to other people, because no two people are on the same journey. And, you know, it's the old analogy of the iceberg. We all see this, you know, the iceberg at the top of the water, but actually the success, the hard work has all been what's beneath the surface. So I think take everything with a pinch of salt, because nothing in life worth having ever comes easy. And I think if you focus so much on the negative, you are at risk of losing so many positive, successful, results and feelings, and more than anything, you owe it to yourself.
That is absolutely wonderful advice. Thank you so much, Tony. You are obviously brave, bold and brilliant, all rolled into one. And I really appreciate you taking the time to have a chat. It's been wonderful. Thank you.